Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything to bring before the Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware will now draw near and give their attendance. The court is now open. God save the state and the Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Morning, Counsel.
Morning, Your Honors. Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs. May it please the court, for the record, I am Bruce Silverstein, and I appear today on behalf of the appellants who are the defendants below. This is an appeal from a grant of partial summary judgment to the plaintiff below, which is a trustee under a bond indenture. The issues on appeal center around the relationship between two limited liability companies, U.S. Timberlands Klamath Falls LLC, which is the issuer of the bonds covered by the indenture, and U.S. Timberlands Yakima LLC. And as in the briefs, if it pleases the court, I'll refer to these two entities as Klamath and Yakima. The crux of the party's dispute arises out of two provisions of the indenture, namely the definition of the term subsidiary and Section 4.10 of the indenture, which is a restrictive covenant that prohibits Klamath from encumbering its assets without giving equal and ratable security to the noteholders, and this is the point of contention, also requires that Klamath, quote, not permit, close quote, its subsidiaries, as defined in the indenture, from doing the same. And there are three issues raised by this appeal. Very broadly stated, they're as follows. One, the first issue is, what is the meaning of the word subsidiary as used in the bond indenture? Second is, what is the legal effect of a refinancing transaction that occurred at Yakima on September 14th, 2001? And the third issue is, what is the proper procedure for dealing with affirmative defenses on a plaintiff's motion for partial summary judgment? Now, that's the order that the issues are presented in the briefs. Unless the court has a contrary preference, however, I'd like to address the issues in the opposite order because I believe the third issue is the simplest to address and the second issue is actually easier than the first issue. With respect to the affirmative defenses issue, there are a couple of matters that are undisputed. It's undisputed that the defendants assert that the plaintiff's claims, and in particular the claim under Section 4.10 of the indenture, is barred by latches and equitable estoppel. Those are affirmative defenses. The defendants at trial will bear the burden on those defenses. It's also undisputed that the Court of Chancery ruled that the resolution of the merits of these affirmative defenses must await a further development of the factual record. The Court did not conclude that these affirmative defenses are invalid, didn't conclude that they're valid, just that they must be determined at a later date. Plaintiff concedes that it's not entitled to summary judgment unless the affirmative defenses lack merit. And that's black letter law. We've cited cases in our brief. There's no cases to the contrary that have been cited, and there's no cases to the contrary that we're aware of. The only issue is whether a defendant must proffer evidence in support of its affirmative defenses to resist a motion for summary judgment by the plaintiff, or whether it's the obligation of the plaintiff to initially come forward with a record that the affirmative defenses will fail before the defendant must say a word about those affirmative defenses. That's an issue of first impression in this court. And it's actually an issue until a very recent decision by Vice Chancellor Stryne, issue of first impression in the lower courts. That was the decision of the Superior Court. Outside of Delaware, however, the courts of appeals have uniformly held that where an affirmative defense is asserted and a plaintiff seeks summary judgment, the plaintiff must in the first instance affirmatively disprove, or must come forward with some evidence that disproves the affirmative defenses before the defendant has a burden of coming forward with anything. That didn't occur here. And for that simple reason, the summary judgment should have been denied. And we would ask that on that reason, for that basis alone, this court vacate the grant of summary judgment. Now, that doesn't really get us entirely where we want to be, and in fact, in the absence of vacating the entire summary judgment, would still leave us with the problem that the court below is of the view that unless the affirmative defenses prevail, the plaintiff will prevail. So I turn to the issue of the cure. The restrictive covenant at issue here was one, as I said, that Yakima was not permitted to encumber its assets without giving protection to the noteholders, and it also was not permitted to allow its subsidiaries to do the same thing. It's alleged, and the court found, and I'll come to that in a few moments, it's alleged that Yakima was a subsidiary of Klamath and that Yakima encumbered its assets without giving equal and ratable protection to the noteholders. Accordingly, the plaintiff argues, and the Court of Chancery concluded, because Yakima did this, and because Yakima, in the Court of Chancery's view, is a subsidiary of Klamath, the indenture was violated when Yakima encumbered its assets without giving equal and ratable protection to the noteholders. That seems pretty straightforward if Yakima is a subsidiary. However, on September 14, 2001, this is a couple years after the indenture was created and a number of years before any suit was brought, Yakima was refinanced and restructured. In that transaction, the encumbrances that were granted to, it was the Bank of Montreal to whom the encumbrances were granted, were released by the Bank of Montreal. At that same time, this is critical, at that same time, Yakima's operating agreement was amended in a manner which the plaintiffs concede for purposes of summary judgment stopped Yakima from being a subsidiary of Klamath. So as of September
14th. The amendment on September the 14th?
Yes, the amendment on September 14th, 2001 eliminated whatever voting rights, and I'll talk about those voting rights in a few moments, whatever voting rights Klamath had with respect to the election of the manager of Yakima. And accordingly, it's undisputed for purposes of summary judgment that from that date forward, Yakima was not a subsidiary of Klamath and was not subject to the restrictions in the indenture.
Well, there does appear to be some dispute, if one believes the answering brief. The other side does seem to dispute what you say is undisputed.
They dispute it for purposes of trial, but for purposes of summary judgment, they acknowledge that there's an issue of material fact as to whether Yakima was a subsidiary as of that date.
All right. The basis for the Court of Chancery's holding that Yakima was a subsidiary were the voting rights that Klamath had in Yakima, in the Yakima preferred interest. Is that right?
That's correct.
Your argument is that those preferred interests were eliminated as a consequence of the amendment of the governing instrument in the refinancing.
That's right. And there's no dispute that that occurred. The argument that they continue to make.
There's no dispute that occurred. That's You're right. Saying the legal consequence of that is to eliminate the status of Yakima's of subsidiary.
And the reason I say that's right, and the reason we
and,
say
but
that.
By doing that. And which was, by the way, a unilateral act, or at least an act on the part of your clients, apparently without the consent of the trustee, was to remove the protection that the court held existed immediately before September 14, 2001. Isn't that correct?
Well, in one sense,
isn't that correct?
In one sense, that is correct, but in one sense, it's not, Your Honor. It wasn't a unilateral act.
Well, if the governing instrument had not been amended, then your client would continue to be a subsidiary, and the default or the violation that was found to exist would continue in effect, would it not?
That's absolutely correct. But this was not a unilateral act of Yakima. Yakima and Klamath agreed to this.
Yakima and Klamath both controlled by one man.
That's absolutely correct. Why don't I turn then to the subsidiary issue? Because the fact that they were both controlled by one man doesn't make Yakima a subsidiary of Klamath.
But the question I want you to focus on is this. Even if you're right that the technical legal consequence of amending the governing instrument was to eliminate the subsidiary status of Yakima, wasn't the act of doing that a separate wrong with respect to the rights of the trustee?
I appreciate that question. It's an excellent question. The answer is no. The answer is we do not believe so. However,
why not?
Because the amendment was done in strict compliance with contractual obligations and fiduciary obligations, and that may or may not be an issue that will be resolved at a future date.
Contractual obligations?
Well, that's the point. There were no contractual restrictions in the indenture, none that have been identified by the plaintiff, none that we're aware of, that would prevent this amendment to the operating agreement.
Wouldn't the elimination of the subsidiary status be at the very least a violation of the duty to perform the contract in good faith?
Well, we do not believe so, but if the plaintiff believes so, they have the ability to sue on that basis. That was not an issue that they raised in their complaint. It's not an issue that they've raised even in their various amendment complaints that have been filed, including subsequent to this opinion by the Court of Chancery. So if they believe that there is something wrongful about the amendment to the Yakima operating agreement vis-a-vis the indenture or vis-a-vis fiduciary obligations, they have the ability to sue on that basis. That's not what they sued on, and that does not change the legal analysis of the effect of the recapitalization and restructuring.
They did claim
Mr. Silverstein, where does the adequacy of the consideration fit into all of this? You seem to be suggesting that partial summary judgment was inappropriate because the transfer of the assets still protected the indenture holders because there was adequate consideration.
That's right.
But it seems that the vice chancellor, when he looked at one lien being substituted for another lien, still thought there was a problem. And it relates in part to the original inadequacy of the consideration.
That's right. And if the original if the consideration was inadequate, that's a different cause of action that's been asserted by the plaintiffs as well. If the consideration was adequate, however, it's not relevant that it was encumbered by the subsidiary because Klamath received assets which themselves were not encumbered in consideration of the assets that it transferred to Yakima. There are various provisions in this indenture that deal with the permissibility of transfers between and among Klamath and any other entity, whether it's an affiliate, a subsidiary, or otherwise. There are provisions that deal with what the subsidiaries of Klamath may do. But the court, we believe, confused these concepts. The transfers may or may not be lawful. We contend that they were lawful. Plaintiff contends they were unlawful. There's going to be a trial on that issue. If they were lawful, it doesn't affect the analysis of the encumbrances. It doesn't affect the analysis of the recapitalization that occurred. And again, to get back to this point, the recapitalization itself is not being challenged in the suit, and it, we believe, would be an error of law to confuse the adequacy and propriety of that recapitalization on the one hand with the question of whether it did cure the alleged default on the other hand. I had requested 10 minutes rebuttal. I'm already into my time, but I just want to make one last point before I cede the podium. We had not cited, and I apologize for this, it's my fault, the Weinstein Enterprises versus Orloff decision of this court, which was decided 2 days before we filed our brief, and I did not find it until doing research on an unrelated matter. But I think there's an important point in that decision that bears noting, which is that the court recognized in that case that a statute, not the contract, but a statute which talked about a subsidiary and the obligations of a parent to do things at the subsidiary level, obviously needs to be construed in a manner by which it needs to be construed only in circumstances where the parent has actual control over the subsidiary to cause it to comply with that obligation that's imposed on the parent. The same is true here. This indenture places restrictions on Klamath, the parent, to require its subsidiaries to do certain things as subsidiaries defined. If Klamath lacked the ability to control Yakima, I want to say parent sub, even though we don't agree it's a sub. If the parent lacks the ability to control the sub, it can't possibly violate an indenture that says that it can't do certain things and it can't permit its subsidiaries to do those things. So it's nonsensical to interpret the indenture in a way in which this company, which isn't under the control of the parent, is a subsidiary of the parent nonetheless.
Well, but the vice chancellor distinguished that by looking at subsidiary as a defined term and then looking at the supermajority vote provision separately.
He did, but I respectfully submit that he disregarded various other provisions within the indenture that give interpretive guidance on what subsidiary is intended to mean, and in particular the provisions that require the parent not to allow its subsidiary to do certain things, and also, I think very importantly, provisions that talk about subsidiary and parent consolidated on financials in accordance with GAAP, and it's undisputed that the parent here, Klamath and Yakima, didn't consolidate their financials, and there's no evidence that they should have consolidated their financials in accordance with GAAP. So there's other language in the indenture that is helpful.
You're making a double-pronged argument, I understand. The first is that the court should have read the control element into the definition of subsidiary as a matter of law.
Yes.
Alternatively, there was at least a tribal issue as to what the parties intended. Is that correct?
That is correct. But we think that the indenture, when read as a whole, leads only to one reasonable interpretation, which is that Yakima was not Klamath subsidiary. But we think that this court doesn't need to get there because we think the cure issue is incontrovertible because the only possible issue with respect to the cure is the issue Your Honor raised about whether there's a cause of action that could be separately brought regarding the recapitalization. But that itself is not an answer to whether the cure was effective. Thank you.
Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Steele, Justice Jacobs. My name is Daniel Rath. May it please the court, with Your Honor's permission, Jerome Muranowski of the firm Fagerie Benson will present the argument this morning on behalf of U.S. Bank.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you. Good morning. Justices Holland, Steele, Justice Steele, and Justice Jacobs. I represent the trustee on this matter. Let me take just one moment to talk about the basic facts on this case before I get to the specifics of the appeal. This Klamath, U.S. Timberland's Klamath Falls, was capitalized back in 1997. It was controlled by Mr. Rudy, one of the defendants here. The initial capitalization was $144 million of equity raised by a public offering of common units of the partnership, which owned Klamath. That was raised. Mr. Rudy put in net $2.3 million into the company. The other part of the capitalization was the sale to public to the public of the $225 million of notes that the trustee is the representative of the note holders on. The terms of the notes were the payment of interest on a semi-annual basis until the year 2007, at which time the entire principal became due and owing. The basic structure of the deal, as set forth in prospectuses, et cetera, laid out a plan to manage the properties, the timberlands, in a way that the timberlands would be harvested at a sustainable level. That would mean that the timberlands would not be depleted. What ended up actually happening is, by the own admissions of the part of Klamath, that overharvesting occurred, such that in the first 3 years there a great deal of timber was taken off the properties, and all of that was done to permit monies to flow to the equity, particularly to the subordinated units held by Mr. Rudy. Mr. Rudy received $26.8 million in those initial 3 years, 10 times his initial investment. In addition to the overharvesting, we have a situation where, beginning in 1999, a total of almost $72 million of timberlands were transferred from Klamath to Yakima in exchange for preferred interests. The Klamath was owned by the partnership, which was 99% owned by the partnership, which is a division of the ownership between the common unit holders and Mr. Rudy's subordinated units. When the timberlands were transferred to Yakima, they became primarily owned by Mr. Rudy's company Holdings. 51% of the common interests were owned by Holdings, and only 49% were owned by the partnership. So there was a conflict of interest, obviously, very clearly in those transfers with respect to Mr. Rudy. The preferred interests that were issued were carried a 5% dividend, but they were not to be paid in cash. They were paid in kind, so accrued. There were nominal dates in the initial preferred interests, nominal dates for the redemption. However, the redemption rights were trumped by any credit agreement that called for a later redemption or elimination redemption rights.
Well, and the record reflects nothing's ever been paid. Is that correct?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Even though they are described in their SEC filings as guaranteed, not a penny of these preferred interests have been paid. Finally, because of the overharvesting that occurred, there was a problem with the ability of Klamath to generate cash from its operations to pay the interest payments. And we will prove at trial, based on the discovery in this case, that the that since November of 2001, every interest payment that was made was made by Klamath selling its assets, its land, timberlands. The net effect of this is that a company that started in 1997 with 630,000 acres of timberlands valued at $373 million today has 272,000 acres valued at $97 million. Obviously, there's it's going to be impossible to pay off these bonds. And one other factor in terms of the interest payments, the court should probably know that the May 15th, 2005 payment has not been paid. We're into the grace period. But the court did take this expedited appeal or interlocutory appeal based on allegations of damage to the company. But all of that may be swept away shortly.
Well, the master facts, as I understand them, are that the most valuable timberlands that were owned by Klamath were transferred to Yakima and returned for a preferred interest in Yakima.
That's correct.
And then shortly or immediately thereafter, that is after every transfer, the properties that were transferred were encumbered.
Exactly.
My question is, was the I know that that you claim wrongdoing in those transactions. Clearly, as a result of the lien transactions. But are you also claiming that the transfers themselves were contractual or fiduciary violations?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. We have those claims against all of the directors. We also have claims for breach of fraudulent conveyances because the amounts the value of the preferred was much smaller than the value of the
timberland. Is it correct that only the lien aspect of the transactions is before us today?
Exactly, Your Honor, and only with respect to the first $40.5 million of transfers that occurred prior to the amendment of the operating agreement, because we felt that there was no question about the interpretation of the indenture, and it would be prior to the amendment, and it would be appropriate for summary judgment. That's why we proceeded on just that.
Did the Court of Chancery ever address the adequacy of the consideration?
That is a subject for trial, which is scheduled to begin on June 20th of this month.
But why isn't that relevant if there was a substitution of assets of adequate value before we get to the propriety of the liens?
I think before the court is the issue of whether there was a violation of the indenture. And if there was a violation or a breach of the indenture, whether the trustee followed the determination of a default with a notice of acceleration. So that's the issue of damages that might have flowed from this is possibly a matter that will be subject to trial. But the issue of a violation of the indenture, I think, is one that can be. Or a breach of the indenture can be determined without the determination of the relative values of the.
Well, let's assume that we can do that. What's your position with regard to the argument that there was a cure as a result of the September 14th agreement?
Our position, Your Honor, is that as the Court of Chancery stated, you cannot cure a breach of a contract by simply replacing a lien that was issued by one bank by a lien issued by another bank, particularly in this case where we have a lien by the Bank of Montreal for $52 million as a result of the refinancing, a guaranteed by MBIA of $95 million.
But does that argument, is that argument responsive? There's another element here that your friends on the other side rely on, and that is that not only was there a substitution of a lien, but the very features of your client's interest that gave rise to protected rights under the indenture were eliminated in the amendment of the governing instrument.
Justice Jacobs, I believe the first issue probably is whether these were two separate legal acts, as the defendants argue. The idea of this lien of the Bank of Montreal being paid off separate from the institution of the lien by MBIA at a time when this new indenture was issued.
What your opponent is saying is, if putting aside the adequacy of the consideration, if you're right that initially we had a problem because the subsidiary was involved and the lien therefore was in event of default. As a result of the amendment, there was a cure because there was no longer this subsidiary status. And what the Court of Chancery seemed to do was say one lien was replaced with another lien, but did the court ever address whether or not there had been a change in the status as a subsidiary?
It did not, because I believe the Court of Chancery didn't consider that to be relevant to the analysis. I believe
your brief doesn't address it either. All it does, it appears, is simply quote what the Court of Chancery said without independently attempting to show why that the Court of Chancery's reasoning is correct.
I think the reasoning would go, Justice Jacobs, is that there was no cure of the violation because one lien was replaced by another. That lien could not, the Bank of Montreal lien could never have been taken off except for the money borrowed from MBIA.
If a lien under the indenture is a violation because the status of the entity is a subsidiary, and at the time of the second lien, that subsidiary status no longer exists, doesn't that demolish your position?
No, Your Honor, because we believe the violation of the indenture has continued. And also, if we're going to deal with these two acts as two separate acts, two separate loans, two separate liens, if there is an elimination of the interests of the voting rights of Klamath, then these transactions fall under the provisions of Section 4.11 of the indenture, which requires that if assets are transferred to an affiliate, which there's no doubt that they always were an affiliate, if they're transferred to an affiliate, then there are requirements that are laid out in the indenture, Section 411, that require that it be on terms that were at least as favorable as could be obtained from a third party. There's requirements for fairness opinions from nationally recognized investment banks, et cetera, which were never done here.
Your argument, I realize that it has to be fairly flexible, but the assets had already been transferred. And so to reconstruct the transaction as one with an affiliate when your initial argument was it was a transaction with a subsidiary seems somewhat confusing. Your first argument's dependent on subsidiary status, and they're trying to address that with their argument that there's been a cure. And then you're suggesting that there's been a transfer to an affiliate, but that had occurred a long time ago. What you have is an encumbrance of assets that are previously transferred.
Justice Allen, if what the defendants are arguing essentially is that because the indenture provides that as long as assets are transferred to a subsidiary, they have to be follow restrictions on those assets. But if they're transferred to the affiliates, as long as they're transferred on fair terms subject to the indenture, they don't have to be followed. They're essentially suggesting that manipulation of the indenture, where they would transfer assets from Klamath to Yakima while Yakima is a subsidiary, which doesn't require the obligations of 411 to be met. And then they would change status of of Yakima, so that the restrictions of the indenture that applies to subsidiaries would not apply. So they would, in essence, actually evade the requirements of the indenture.
Well, let me see if I have this right. You're making an alternative argument, as I see it. The first argument is that this transaction should be viewed as if it were one continuous lien, even though there was a refinancing.
Yes,
and if that's the case, then the wrongdoing that existed at the time of the first lien continued through the second lien, regardless of form.
Yes.
Second argument is that, in the alternative, if these are two separate transactions and are regarded as such, then there's a separate violation of the indenture, namely Section 411, for the reasons that you argued.
Exactly.
Did you make that argument in your brief in response to the cure contention? I don't recall saying it.
I don't recall, Your Honor. It was discussed at oral argument. The judge talked about Vice Chancellor Lamb talked about the issue of whether this should be considered as two separate transactions and essentially a constructive transfer, but decided the case on the basis that, that there is no substance to the argument that's being made. There was a continuous lien paid off by a new loan, so there's no actual effect on the interests of the note holders by these changes of status.
But did I understand your 411 argument to be that if adequate consideration had been paid, then there would not be a violation? So when you move to your alternative argument, the consideration for the transfer becomes important.
Your Honor, I think that on the face of it, there is no compliance with Section 411. The parties, the defendants, argued that these transactions were excluded from 411 because they under an interpretation of permitted investments, which was an argument that was rejected. So they did not comply with the provisions of 411. There's no dispute about that. That argument or that position was decided, or the issue of whether it's these whether transfers to an affiliate are subject to Section 411 was decided as part of the Court of Chancery's memorandum opinion. He determined it does apply.
In the short amount of time that you have left, you know, we're talking about these facts, and there hasn't been a trial. Given everything we've discussed, why was any aspect of this case appropriate for summary judgment?
Your Honor, because simply the plain language of the indenture provides that Yakima was a subsidiary at the time at least of the first $40.5 million of transfers, and they subsequently encumbered those assets. And that, Your Honor, is the Court of Chancery found was a breach of the indenture, which leads to an event of default and ultimately to an acceleration. And that's why we felt there was no genuine issue of material fact regarding any of those issues, and that's what we presented to the court, in part because of to pursue claims to protect the interests of bondholders on undisputed facts that we believe entitled or determined or established an event of default.
Before you finish, we're told by the appellants that there's an issue of first impression before us concerning the affirmative defenses and who has the burden of going forward for summary judgment. Would you address that issue?
Yes, Your Honor. We vigorously disagree that there that is uniformly held outside of the state of Delaware, that the moving party in a summary judgment motion has the burden of coming forward with proofs of evidence to disprove.
Well, let's assume we're not concerned about what's uniformly held outside of Delaware. What is the right thing to do? What is the proper way to proceed on this issue as you see it?
I think we proceeded in the trial court, we presented evidence, undisputed facts regarding the elements of our cause of action, and the burden is on the defendants to set forth some evidence, admissible evidence by affidavit or otherwise, that would create a genuine issue of material fact with respect to their affirmative defenses. I believe that's consistent with the law in Delaware. The Skirman decision, for instance, talks about the requirement of the of on a summary judgment motion that there is a burden on the opposing party to adequately support the latches and equitable estoppel defenses. And I think from the clear reading of 56E, which requires parties to not rest on their averments or pleading in their pleadings, but actually present some affidavit evidence that's consistent with what happened here. I would also say that we fully briefed in our brief in the lower court the issue of the untimeliness of our claims, and also pointed out that there was no evidence whatsoever of prejudice, an element that was required, and there was nothing done by the defendants to come forward with any facts or to address those issues.
Well, let me see if I understand your procedural position. On a motion for summary judgment, you agree you need to come forward and establish an event of default, and then the defendant has a couple of options. One is to create a material dispute of fact that there is a event of default, and in this case, the alternative would be to come forward with evidence that there were affirmative defenses, even if there was an event of default.
Exactly, exactly. And I believe that's what Vice Chancellor Lamb went to in terms of referring to the requirement of coming forward with evidence of to support their position. I think it's particularly important here because the issue that they didn't present any evidence on is prejudice for any alleged delay, which is something that the trustee is not in a position to disprove. So accordingly, it's something that ought to be it is clearly the burden on an affirmative defense to the defendants.
Thank you.
Your Honors, start at this point of manipulation of the indenture. I mean, first of all, the summary judgment motion made before there was any discovery. It was made basically when there was just a complaint on file. There wasn't even an answer on file yet, although we had informed them of what our affirmative defenses would be. There was no manipulation of the indenture here. The plaintiff would like the court to believe, and I don't think this is strictly relevant to the issues on appeal, but they would like the court to believe that what happened here was that the defendants first made these various transfers without regard to the adequacy of the consideration based on the view that it was a subsidiary, that Yakima was a subsidiary, and therefore transfers could be made freely without regard to the consideration. And then they manipulated the indenture further by removing the voting rights and saying now it's no longer a subsidiary, we can cure the encumbrances. The defendants acted at all.
They persuaded the vice chancellor of that, didn't they?
They did. They persuaded him of that based on their record. And it was their burden to establish that the record was undisputedly in their favor. What happened here was that the defendants made these transfers under the belief that Yakima was not a subsidiary. It is our contention to this moment that Yakima was not a subsidiary, that the transfers were subject to the affiliate restrictions in the indenture, and that is going to be tried. Perhaps it won't be tried if the subsidiary findings stands, but that is an issue we're prepared to try and defend, that those transactions were appropriate transactions between affiliates. So they weren't made for no consideration. They were made for consideration that defendants believed to be appropriate under the terms of the indenture. No one believed there was a subsidiary. And at the time of the restructuring, nobody believed that the restructuring was necessary to eliminate the status of subsidiary.
This, I gather, is an offer of proof, not something that's established in the
yes,
record.
Yes, that's correct. But the Court of Chancery presumed or assumed that this was done because of a belief that Yakima was a subsidiary and to eliminate that. There's no evidence of that, and we will prove at trial that that was not the case. Nobody was operating under the belief, including the plaintiff. No one was operating under the belief that Yakima was a subsidiary. In fact, they wouldn't be suing on the adequacy of the consideration if they believed that Yakima was a subsidiary, because the indenture plainly provides that there can be no consideration for transfers from a parent to a subsidiary under the indenture. So there was no intent to manipulate the indenture. What there was, however, was undeniably a real refinancing transaction, one that did occur, one that was publicly disclosed, in fact. And in connection with that transaction and prior to the placement of the security interests on behalf of MBIA, which are the only interests that exist to this day and were the only interests that existed, security interests that existed at the time the Court of Chancery heard this case, prior to that occurring, Yakima was not a subsidiary, at least for purposes of the summary judgment record. We would submit that there can be no dispute that Yakima was not a subsidiary at that point, because the hinge upon which the plaintiff relies to establish that Yakima was a subsidiary is this voting interest, which was eliminated. So on September 14th, there's no more voting interest. On September 14th, there was an elimination of the prior liens, and on September 14th, there is a new lien with a new bank created, not an assignment of the old lien, a new lien.
Well, isn't the question whether equity will give full effect, full legal effect to that transaction?
I don't believe so. I believe that this aspect of the case is a legal aspect of the case, not an equitable aspect of the case. The case is in chancery, but that's a legal claim under the indenture. And if they believe there's a wrong that occurred by the release of the voting rights, that's a separate claim under the indenture.
Which you say they haven't made?
Which they have not made. Okay. Second point, to address Justice Holland's question, and I think I might have misunderstood the question before. 4.11 and 4.10 are separate and distinct. Okay. If Yakima were a subsidiary of Klamath, then it wouldn't matter if Yakima overpaid for the assets that were transferred to it. Placing encumbrances on the assets at Yakima would violate 4.10. Wouldn't matter what Yakima paid for them. If Yakima were not a subsidiary, it also wouldn't matter what it paid for the assets. It could freely encumber its assets under 4.10 because 4.10 would have no application to Yakima. By the same token, under Section 4.11, if Yakima is a subsidiary, assets can be freely transferred without regard to the consideration. And by the same token, under 4.11, if Yakima is not a subsidiary, if it's an affiliate, there are you have to look at 4.11 to determine whether the transfers were appropriate. But the point we were making in the brief, which I may have started the confusion, is that so long as the transfers were, in fact, for adequate consideration, it really shouldn't matter in equity if there was a violation of 4.10 because the noteholders were nonetheless fully protected. So it's an equitable defense of sorts. And it was only in response to their point that there was a manipulation that they're left without protection. I know my time is short. My last point is on the affirmative defenses. Rule 56 clearly states that the moving party has an obligation to come forward with evidence that there's an absence of support for the whatever it's seeking relief on. They didn't come forward with any evidence with respect to our affirmative defenses. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
All rise.